Lynn Hood from EPA Region 10 to provide a brief welcome. Lynn?
Hi, and thanks, Jean. I also just want to thank everyone for tuning in today. This three-part series on NEPA and Mining 101 has previously only been delivered in person at a handful of events. So we're really excited to bring this to a wider audience through Clouin. And thanks to Jean and the people behind the scenes for making that happen. Our speakers today, who Jean will introduce in just a moment, have years of experience in mining and mine site cleanup. So please take advantage of this time with them today and ask any questions that you have. I hope that you find this session engaging, and whether you're new to the world of mining or have years of experience, hopefully you'll take away some nuggets of info from the discussion today. So thank you again, and now I'll turn it back over to Jean.
All right, fantastic. So we're going to work on our introductions right now, and I've opened up some interactive polls in the lower left half of everyone's screen. So I'd like to ask our participants to take a moment and indicate their affiliation as well as their years of experience with mining sites so that we can get a sense of those of you joining us virtually around the webinar environment today. And in just a moment, we'll take a look to see who's joining us. Again, you'll be able to watch as those votes come in real time. This will help our instructors understand who they're speaking with. And while you all are sharing information about yourself, again, I wanted to remind everyone that this course is designed to provide an overview of mining in NEPA and is geared towards how tribes can participate in the NEPA process. Part two of this three-part series will explore environmental concerns at mining sites and how issues can be addressed. We'll specifically look at topics like types of waste products, surface and groundwater concerns, water treatment, and potential air issues. And you should walk away today with a basic understanding of these types of issues that can occur at mining sites and be able to pose questions and share comments with our instructors. So again, I encourage you to take advantage of that Q&A window to share your comments and questions today. We'll be joined by two instructors today. Our first instructor will be Shahid Muhammad from EPA's headquarters program here in Superfund, where he is the team leader for the EPA's Abandoned Mine Lands team and the co-chair of EPA's National Mining Team and the National Lead Sites Work Group. He has over 25 years of experience with EPA in developing regulations and policies on environmental characterization, control, and remediation of waste sites in EPA's solid waste and Superfund programs. And then we'll also be joined by our second presenter, who is John Hillebrand, who is joining us from EPA Region 9, where he serves as a regional coordinator for mining activities and provides technical expertise to the mine site caseworkers within Region 9, as well as serving as a co-chair of EPA's National Mining Team. So before I turn things over to those gentlemen, let's take a look and see how you've voted in our poll today. Again, to submit your vote, you simply need to click on the circle of the answer that most closely matches your individual reply. And if you haven't voted, now is the chance to take one last moment and click your votes in for today's broadcast. It does look like we have a nice mix of participants. Almost 28%, or just over 28% of the audience is coming in from the private sector. And then federal representatives make up about a quarter of our audience. We have some state representatives as well as tribal participants. About 16% of you are coming from tribal affiliations, so that's great. We do have a few academic participants joining us as well as a number of site owner operators or those of you that affiliate yourselves in another way. So thanks for sharing that background information. And in terms of experience, we do have a big range here. We run the gamut. About a quarter of the audience is brand new to mining sites, having less than a year. A quarter of you have some experience between 1 and 5 years. About just over 21% have been working on mining sites for 5 or 10 years, and then 28% of you have 10 or more years, so I would consider you very seasoned veterans with mining sites. So I think you have a great representation of participants covering different organizations as well as years of experience, so I encourage you to interact and participate actively in today's broadcast. So thanks so much for sharing those votes with us. Let me go ahead and turn things over to your first instructor today. We'll pull up the presentation materials, and in just a moment, Shahid, whenever you see the materials appear on your end, you can feel free to kick things off.
All right. Thank you, Jean, and good afternoon, everybody. And that's a really good distribution, as you said, Jean, of individuals participating on this call. Again, as Jean said, I'm Shahid Mahmood. I'm the co-chair of the National Mining Team, and during this presentation today, my other co-chair, John Hillebrand from Region 9 in San Francisco, will cover parts of this presentation. So what I wanted to do is just sort of jump into, as Jean said, that this is the second part of a series of three Mining 101 and NEPA discussions. I think a few weeks ago we had a discussion on the mining fundamentals. Today we want to cover the environmental concerns and issues, as well as, you know, predicting and preventing and controlling impacts from mining, hard rock mining sites. So this is going to be the focus of our presentation today. And what we'll do is the first two bullets, which goes into the waste products, including the waste rock tailings, as well as contaminated waters and other features that lead to the contamination, the potential environmental impacts from mines to water, air, and soil. So those first two bullets I will provide an overview on. John will jump in and talk about the ways of preventing and controlling the impacts while the mines are operational, or when you're trying to design a mine or bring it online, what you can do, what kind of measures, and what kind of predictions that you can make to control some of the impacts so the long-term legacy or impacts associated with these could be minimized. And then finally, I'll come back around and talk about more so on the Superfund cleanup and remediation of these sites that are, a lot of these sites are, you know, really old and historic and hundreds of years old, which, you know, there were not many environmental controls associated with that at that time. So a lot of those sites end up on the Superfund program, which we need to address. So with that, that's just an introduction of how we're going to be covering this module two today, for, you know, highlighting and providing an overview of the concerns associated with these hard rock mine sites. Okay, this is, just wanted to get into just what we'll be talking about. The first two bullets, which is the overburden and waste rock, is when you're getting into and getting to the ore body to try to get to the actual metal that you're trying to mine for. There's overburden and waste rock associated with these mines, so I'll just cover a little bit of that. Tailings, which is a big issue and a big concern globally, is the second part that I'm going to be talking about. I don't have any pictures of heap leach and spent ore in this particular presentation, but I can briefly touch on that. Then the wastewater and air emissions associated with these sites. And this is the Green Creeks mine site in Alaska, which is a silver, it's a silver mine, and it's an underground mine with some of the features that are shown on this picture. So here's an overview. I just wanted to provide an overview. This is the Fort Knox mine in Alaska. It's an open pit mine. It's a gold mine. And Gene, I'm going to try to look for the arrow thing. Sorry. Thanks. So this is the ore body that we're trying to that the miners are kind of trying to capture. Over here is the overburden material that needs to be, you know, blasted out and dug out to get to the ore body. Again, this is what in the red line is what we're trying to capture in terms of the metals and their value. There's other parts of it between the red lines, which is the waste that's also associated with the ore. And if you go to the right over here, is the when you try to get the ore, there's a lot of waste associated with it. So you need to, you know, there's a waste rock pile over here. There's a mill over here, which in essence, when you're trying to process the ore, you need to refine it to get the ore out. You do the milling and basically mixing it with either chemicals or water, separating the ore body, and then what's left behind in a slurry form is pumped to what they call a tailings pond or a tailings dam. So just wanted to provide an overview of mining operations so you can, when I talk through these different types of features, it sort of give you a pictorial of what's associated that, you know, this is an open pit mine in Alaska. So I just wanted to show that what we're going to be covering right now. So I'll go back again. I'm going to talk about this waste rock pile. And this is the Thompson Creek site. It's a molybdenum mine site in Idaho. And so what what that consists of is this waste rock pile over here. What it is, again, going back to this picture, is, you know, you're trying to get the ore out, and in essence, when you blast it out and you try to separate out the material to get the ore, there's mineralized rock that doesn't have any economic value to what you're trying to recover. And then basically that becomes waste rock. And generally, for every ton of ore mined, there's about 1 to 4 tons of waste rock that's produced. So there's a lot of, as you can see, there's a lot of volume and waste associated with trying to tap in and get to the ore itself for economic purposes. So this is something that I wanted to show a picture of this. These are pretty large footprint area over here. And it's waste rock pile, which is a mineralized rock, which can also lead to other environmental issues, which I will cover a little bit later on. So that's the waste rock pile, and that's the Thompson Creek mine site, the molybdenum mine in Idaho. If we can get to the next one, I want to cover tailings. Again, if I'll go back a couple of slides, this is the area that I'm talking about, is the tailings. So let me jump back up. So tailings, what these are is, and I think some of the folks participated in the first session, the first module, when people went over the mining fundamentals. So tailings really are the ground-up remains of mineral processing. So in other words, when you're processing the ore and trying to extract out the valuable metals from it, you crush it and grind it, you mix it with water or some sort of a chemicals to extract out the metals in some sort of a froth process, a flotation device, and you try to recover the froth portion, the metals which are stuck to the chemicals are going on top, but the remainder, which is about 85 to 95% of this milled material, end up as tailings. So these are like slurry forms, which may have 20% or so of solids, but the rest of them is water or liquid. So it's a slurry form that needs to be disposed of. And what we wanted to talk about is generally the disposal methods for these tailings, and they'll include the tailings impoundments or tailings dams. We're talking about the paste tailings or dry stack tailings, and then an option that was proposed in 2009 at the Kensington mine is disposal in a lake of tailings. To get to the first one, this is a tailings impoundment. This is for the Red Dog mine, which is a zinc mine up in Alaska. And this was built across streams and valleys in the upland. And as you can see, I'm having a tough time with this. Okay, so this is basically the dam. And in essence, what you're looking at, that this could be hundreds of feet high, and you have the freshwater reservoir here. Here's the tailings dam. It's an earthen dam that was built to hold the tailings or the slurry that I was talking about in the previous slide that is disposed of over here. This one in this particular facility has a plastic liner or HDP liner, and then a compacted soil liner, so it could contain some of the leaching that may happen from these tailings facilities. So this is basically a pretty well designed system over here for the Red Dog mine to contain any type of releases from this type of a facility. So this is basically a conventional tailings impoundment that's just wanted to show you that as one of the impacts of mining. And this is a pretty big footprint as well. Again, this is another site. This is a tailings impoundment in Thompson Creek mine, for the Thompson Creek mine in Idaho. This is a molybdenum mine. And as you can see, and I'll take the, this is a pretty high, a pretty, you know, high site. It's like it's very tall in its feature. So in other words, it's one of those sites that, you know, needs to be careful about, because it's pretty steep and its elevation is pretty high, so it needs to be carefully thinking about that. And then basically from these types of sites, this wet tailings impoundment, you may have problems associated with leaching from the sides or in the front or in the back or into the groundwater. You have water seepage, and you may have, for this particular one, because it's constructed in such steep grade, and in this area, you may also have some geotechnical stability issues or technical issues, structural issues that are associated with these types of sites. So it's not only the environmental part of these sites that we need to be concerned about, but there may be some engineering and technical issues, geotechnical issues that are associated with these types of sites. If we can go to the next one, this is the, I want to just show you the Pogo mine in Alaska. This is a gold mine site, and this is some of the practice that may decrease some of the environmental footprint or the consequences associated with leaching of water-laden tailings, which were the past two pictures that I was kind of showing you, is where you sort of thicken or filter these tailings that are very, very wet, so you can make it, you know, you can add an additive to thicken it to have some sort of a paste form, which could be pumpable, but then you increase the solid contents of that. Or if you have dry tailings, which you may have go through some filter presses and dry it out, and you can get up to 85 to 90% solids and or 10 to 15% moisture content. So the less water you have, the more, you know, the less chances of any type of environmental consequences related, and that less of a hydraulic head that needs to be managed as well. So this is for this one site in Pogo, there was a liner that was placed underneath in a settling pond for any of the material that may be liquid, and the dry stack tailings was put on top. So this is a pretty well-designed type of a facility, going away from, again, from historically where we've been doing wet tailings to dry tailings, which may have, as I said, less environmental consequences associated with it in the future. We can go to another one. This is the Greens Creek mine. Again, this is also in Alaska. Again, this is a silver mine. This is, again, I just wanted to show you the dryness of the tailings. So it's a dry stack tailing with less of the environmental consequences associated with wet tailings. This is another site in Alaska, which is the Kensington mine. This is also this is a gold mine site in Alaska, and the proposal for this one was the disposal of the tailings in this lake, which is Slate Lake, which the tailings would be disposed of to cut off the oxygen supply that may produce less asthma drainage or metal liberation. So this is a proposal that was done. And that was to propose to dispose of these tailings in this lake, Slate Lake. So those are, as I said, in the you know, went to wet tailings to dry and paste tailings to disposal of tailings in this lake in up in Alaska. So that's basically just some of the issues that, you know, showing you some of the pictures of tailings dams and impoundments. But some of the issues that are really of concern, they're not only environmental but also structural issues associated with these tailings dams are, first of all, it's just the location and the potential hazard. Where are they going to locate it? What kind of impact will it have in downstream, maybe sensitive populations or sensitive ecosystems? So that's a concern that we need to be cognizant of. The geology and the seismicity, is it in an earthquake-prone zone? Because if it's an earthquake-prone zone, you know, you have to really consider how this will impact the structural stability and the release of these through some earthquake types of scenarios. And The next one is the hydrology and the hydraulics associated with it. So in other words, you know, it's there because one of the worst enemies of a tailings dam is water. So it's basically if you sort of have water in the tailings that haven't really dried up and you've built the tailings over time, you may have the water that could saturate some of the tailings dam walls. And you could just sort of have a heave type of a factor or structural liquefaction that can happen that can make this sort of a shear or a slide in the tailings that may have an impact and have a some sort of a release that may happen as a result of, you know, if not properly designed and not considering the hydrology and the hydraulics of this particular system. Again, another thing that we have to be concerned about is the structural integrity and slope stability. The structural integrity, is it keyed into some sort of a competent bedrock, or is it sort of lying on some sort of a clay or a silt material which may kind of slide and have some sort of a factor of sort of having impact the dam stability. And the slope stability is, again, basically looking at, you know, in essence, you want to have a slope that's, you know, sort of manageable. Generally, I think design engineers consider 25% to 30% slope should be, you know, something that's going to be walkable rather than having a very steep slope, which may impact the stability of your mine structure or of your tailing structure itself. So that's another issue that needs to be considered when looking at these designing and constructing and operating these tailings dams. Another thing need to be considered is the seepage control there. I mean, a lot of these are wet tailings, and it may percolate down, and you might want to control that, or if something's coming out of the side, have some sort of a control measure to control that seepage and perhaps treat it if it's some sort of a highly metal-laden type of a seepage. Obviously, the design and construction to consider where you place it, what kind of geology, hydrogeology is associated, the hydrology, the stability and the integrity goes into properly designing and constructing these features. However, once you design and construct these features, you need to make sure that you know, they're operated and maintained over time so that, you know, you're watching over it instead of you know, just not having some sort of a check or a maintenance schedule that you need to be involved with. So that's a really key part of these operating facilities, that they need to be operated and maintained over time, and so you don't have some sort of a problem associated with these sites. And then obviously you need to have, you could have the best design in the world. You could have the best engineers designing and constructing it. However, you know, Mother Nature is pretty powerful, and sometimes, you know, just sort of, you need to consider the worst case, and you have some sort of an emergency contingency planning that needs to be planned out just in case there is some sort of a disaster that happens or a release that happens. So anyway, so I'm just sort of wanted to cover that. And with this, I wanted to sort of lay out some of the concerns that was a recent disaster that happened with a dam failure up in Canada. It's the Mont Pauli dam failure. Showing a little video clip of this, and it happened in the middle of the night, and this is the flyover filming it for the next day of the dam failure. Now, this is an extreme example of an anticipated event at a mine, and the majority of the tailings impoundment that the mining companies do are designed and constructed well, and, you know, usually doesn't have lead to this kind of a disaster in this particular situation up in Canada. And, you know, there was, in this 2014 incident, millions of gallons were introduced into this water in the Fraser River watershed, and one of the most important salmon rivers in Canada. And, you know, it's just basically, it was a sad event, but there was also an event that happened in Brazil that was the Samarco tailings dam release, which also had an unfortunate consequence with that as well, with fatalities. And at that time, ICMM, which is the International Council of Mining and Metals, got together. One of the this is ICMM is the comprised of the world's biggest mining companies to convene and to come up with measures to design, come up with better standards for these construction and management of these tailings dams. So, this is basically. Something that these features, they've got a lot of water, they hold water, they have to be designed and constructed properly. If not, these are the consequences that can happen. This is the Mont Pali dam failure situation. But, you know, if most of these are constructed properly, but if they're not, there are these huge damages that can happen. So, Gene, did you want me to continue on this or take because this is a transition point.
We'll go ahead and break very quickly here for some questions that have come in, and we'll just do a very quick time check as well while we're at it. It's 1:30 p.m. Eastern, so we'll take just a few questions now before we transition on in the webinar. So let me just walk through some of the questions that have come in. And one of the first ones, someone asked, how high is the Thompson Creek tailings dam?
I think it's, Lynn, I think you might also be aware of this. This is hundreds of feet high, isn't that?
Yeah, it's, depending on how you measure it, from the toe to the crest, it's about 800 to 900 feet, actually, but from the kind of back side, the base of the impoundment, it's more like 600 or 700, but it's, yeah, quite tall.
It's hundreds of feet high, yeah.
Okay. We did have a few questions about dry stacks, and one of these questions asks, if you place a liner under a dry stack, does that cause stability issues, for example, by keeping water entrained in the dry tails?
I haven't seen any research on that particular type of an issue, but that's a good question that if it's a dry stack, you'll have less water, and if you have a liner underneath it, it may or may not. I haven't seen research on it to show either way how that would go. John, do you know of any research that's out there?
No, I don't. But I believe if that was a concern, you believe you could have some infiltration. You could put a subsurface drain right on top of the liner, so that if water did get in, it would drain safely away and maintain your geotechnical stability.
Okay. Would you consider a dry stack tailings a, quote, best practice?
I would. It's not an EPA. I'm not talking on behalf of the EPA, but my personal belief is, yes, it is a best practice that, you know, should be considered.
Okay. All right, excellent. We do have a few questions about berms, and one of our participants asks, what are the berms made of, and do you have or do you use a specific compaction ratio?
Berms around what, the tailings, or which berms are we talking about? I'm just flipping back on my...
Sure. They didn't specify exactly. They just said in general, what are the berms made of, and they're interested in whatever compaction ratios are used in their construction.
Yeah, I mean, berms I could see around, like, ponds or holding ponds or maybe even tailings, and usually they're made out of the compacted material that's found around the site, but I'm not quite sure what the compaction ratio is on those. It's a site-specific determination.
Okay. And they just did clarify it's for any of the impoundments that you've been showing. That's what they're asking about.
Yeah, I mean, it's just made out of the material that they're from, and then the I don't know what the real compaction ratio is, depending on the site conditions.
Okay. And John, did you have something to add?
I was just going to say the compaction can vary from actual mechanical compacting up to 90% or even more, but typically they're not compacted. They're just slurried in, and they're deposited right on site and then bulldozed to make a new berm. I don't believe they're actively compacted, but like Shahid said, there's a lot of variation on that.
Okay, excellent. We do have another question here. I'll take one more, and then we might carry on with the presentation. Are there any hard rock mines with unlined wet slurry tailing sites that are located on top of a wetlands or old taconite tailings? And I apologize if I mispronounced that.
I don't know, but I think Region 5 has some taconite mines, and I think in Michigan and Upper Peninsula, and I'm not sure, because they're not in our Superfund universe, and I'm not sure what the compositions there is. And
okay.
Anybody else on
Great.
The phone? That, I mean, John, do you know anybody?
No, I'm not up on that.
Yeah, well, we have here in Region 10, the Thompson Creek Mine, the tailing, the slurry tailings is constructed in a stream, basically. So, and there, it's unlined. It's a center line tailings impoundment, so they propel the, the sands onto the dam, and then the kind of finer slurry is behind that, and then they control the any seepage that's coming out of the dam. And that one picture that Shahid showed with the pond at the bottom, which then they can manage and treat.
All right, excellent. Well, I think right now, in the interest of time, we're probably going to go ahead and move on. Again, it's 1:35, and we are carrying on with slide 15 in the presentation.
So this is just basically showing you some of the nice color water that could have happened with some of the mine influence waters that emanate from some of these mine features. This particular one is, I believe, is a shot in Colorado. It's the Cement Creek site up in Colorado. Again, as we showed you just a couple of the features, went over the tailings and the waste rock, but there's other features such as, the open pit, underground workings, and, just areas that were used for processing, like heap leach operations that are used for using cyanide that you introduce through to capture gold, or you could have sulfuric acid going through to catch copper dump piles, which you can extract copper from. So, but there's environmental concerns associated with these different types of features, including, infiltration to groundwater impacts. You have surface water impacts from runoff. You may have soil impacts from just erosion or dust that may be around. Or in previously, you used to have smelters that may have lead contamination that emissions impacted the soil. You have vegetation that may be impacted on and about close proximity of the site. You have habitat and aquatic and uplands that may be impacted by these different types of features and different types of operation. And then, you have air issues associated with these from just the dust and other chemicals that may be out there. Again, as I spoke one slide too early, the sources of this surface and groundwater are, again, you have underground workings for, extracting the ore body. You may have adits and other types of features that are down there that, once they're left and are not controlled, could have impact to the groundwater and surface. The surface water, these are drainages that may happen over time that may have some mine-impacted waters impacting surface and groundwater. Again, open pit mines, once you're done with mining, the pit level, the water level will rise, and it can impact with the rock, which may be sulfide-bearing rock, because it produces mine-influenced waters as well, and you may have connections to underground and then have surface water interactions with that. So that's another source. Another source is, as you saw, the features that we showed up pictures for the waste rock and tailings. These are exposed to the environment. You have water, oxygen, and, you have these features which are mineralized, which could also have mine-impacted waters that influence both surface and groundwater. Again, when you have runoff, you have erosion that can have sedimentation from either waste rock or tailings disposals. And then there's also, as I was saying, you know, you need to have cyanide heap leaches for gold. You have sulfuric acid that's used for extraction of copper and copper dump leaches. And you may have other things that are used for different types of extraction of the ores that may be also a concern to releases to ground and surface water. Again, the biggest thing that most all the world mining companies and all over the world are kind of sort of dealing with is acid mine drainage, you know, which is acid and metals, which including iron, lead, zinc, cadmium, and mercury. And this is one of those things, you know, it's, you still have Venetian and Roman mines that are still acid. They're still going acid. So this is a spigot that you first turn on. It's very tough to turn that spigot off. So the acid mine drainage is a huge concern globally. Then you also have, you know, neutral and alkaline drainage that liberate other metals like selenium, arsenic, and manganese. So it depends on the pH of when the different types of metals are released. But these are concerns if you have this exposure left in place. So anyway, so that's that. And then you also have the other types of chemicals associated with mineral processing, such as I said, you know, sulfuric acid for copper dump leaches, as well as cyanide for gold operations. Again, you know, acid rock drainage, again, or acid mine drainage is generated when you have these different types of metal sulfides that interact with oxygen and water. Typical reaction is, you know, where you have this iron disulfide with oxygen and water gives you this sulfuric acid and this iron hydroxide type of a thing. So it's basically that's, you know, the different types of equations associated with acid rock drainage. But in the upshot is that, you know, having oxygen water with some sort of a metal sulfide that you're interacting with leading to acid rock drainage, which, again, is a gift that keeps on giving. It's a long-term issue that needs to be dealt with. Here's just a cartoon of acid rock drainage. This is, again, you have the underground features, you have some sort of a waste rock over here, you have different types of interactions of water and oxygen, and that gets into the groundwater, and then the groundwater interacts with the surface water, and you can have different types of metals associated with those acid or neutral drainage type of features. Again, this is just nice, colorful iron type of drainage that's happening from historic, and it also happens with, this is more of historic mines, that, you know, you can see this nice color that's coming out. Again, you have other types of metal leaching that happens, and you have, you know, the copper, lead, cadmium, you know, just have a whole bunch of material that's liberated. Again, this is at the site in Blackbird Mine. This is a cobalt mining site, and you can see the drainage over here as well. Other things that can happen at these is, you know, you may have pipelines associated with these sites, which could have sort of like, you know, you could have impacted pipelines that could leak. You have truck incidents that could happen when you have trucks shipping in and out and coming in with different types of chemicals or taking out other types of, so you could have incidents associated with that. You may have liners that may leak, and of course, I showed you the dam failure video clip a little bit earlier. Again, surface water impacts, and coming up on 143, so I'm kind of speed up a little bit here. You have degraded aquatic habitat. You have fish kills or other types of, you know, impacts to wildlife. As you can see, this is from, I think, the Coeur d'Alene site in Bunker Hill, where you have these waterfalls that are impacted. You have sedimentation and then, you know, continued water contamination that goes on for a while. And so then we get to this next one is this Midnight Mine, which was a uranium mine in Washington. It was an open-pit uranium mine and on the Spokane Indian Reservation. It became a Superfund site, by the way, in 2000 when EPA put it on the national priorities list. The investigations to date have found elevated levels of arsenic, cadmium, manganese, and uranium, and then the radioactive decay products from uranium. And they've migrated, and basically it's a big issue over there. And then the mined area contains more than about 33 million tons of waste rock and unprocessed low-grade ore. So again, a lot of this ore, this low-grade ore, is a radioactive area which may have decay products and daughter products that may have radionuclides associated with it that needs to be cleaned up or responded to over the long term. Again, this is the groundwater concern. You have contamination, again, acidity in metals. When you're mining, you may have reduced water because of the dewatering that's going on. You may be drawing down water on the water table. And contamination could be also impacting wetlands and surface water downstream. And then drinking waters can also be impacted by these operations. This is the Holden Mine, which is a copper zinc mine up in Washington. All right, I think that brings me to the close of the environmental consequences, the mine impacts. This is where I sort of hand this off to John to cover the predictions and prevention and control part of it. Gene, did you want to pause and take a questions, or do we want to continue?
Yep. I think we're going to take just one or two comments slash questions now, and then we'll carry on. We did have a few participants just kind of chime in here and mention that specifically for Native communities, that they have cultural, medicinal, and ceremonial plants and other specific soils that they use, which can become impacted at mining sites. And they just wanted to bring that concept up, and I don't know if you can comment on that at all.
That's absolutely correct, because and that is an area, like, you know, we do have like the Midnight Mine, as well as some mines up in Nevada and New Mexico, and especially the uranium mines in the Navajo Nation. Yeah, those are, you know, like the smokehouses or sweat lodges and different types of activities and more that the Native Americans partake in. It's, yeah, that is a pretty big impact, which I did not put in here, but that is a concern as well.
All right, thanks. And we'll take one other question now, and this one gets into mining. One of our attendees mentions that several of your slides discuss mercury as a direct contaminant. They want to know what research data EPA has on the effects of sulfur compounds from mining on methylation in wetlands and sediments and bioaccumulation in the aquatic food chain. Again, it's mentioning that mercury was a direct contaminant, and what research data does EPA have regarding effects of sulfur compounds from mining on mercury methylation in wetlands and sediments?
You know, I'm going to punt that question to John, because he did have a very, very good seminar on mercury in last year in Region 9. I will just sort of ask John if there was anything that was brought up on that.
Yeah, what we found is once mercury gets into lakes and wetlands environments, the amount of sulfate can be really important, not so much sulfur, but sulfate. There seems to be a middle point of sulfate concentrations, which can really increase the rate of methyl production, methylmercury production. So the amount, if you're going to be researching mercury in wetlands or lakes, knowing your sulfate content as well as other geochemical factors are really important for predicting how much will be absorbed.
Excellent. Okay, I think in the interest of time, we'll carry on with the presentation. And again, John Hillebrand is going to take over here. Participants can still submit their comments and questions. I know a lot of you are chiming in with additional statements. Please keep them coming. And we will take another break shortly for Q&A. So John, go ahead.
Okay, thanks a lot. I'm going to jump from waste types and problems that you had covered into more of a predicting and preventing of those problems should they arise. So the first slide will be working here. The first slide will be more of a bigger picture, kind of before we get into the nitty-gritty, there is a 7-step process that EPA uses when you're trying to any kind of environmental impacts, and we call it our data quality planning process, and it's 7 steps. And it takes a while to get comfortable with this. It seems overly generic at first, but what's really good about it is it lets you flesh out upfront all of the environmental issues that you'd probably get at a site by going through 7 steps. For example, stating the problem could be we don't know the chemistry and quantity of water we expect coming from this mine in the future once it's completed or once it's underway. So that would be stated as a problem. Then you would move, you know, purpose of the study is to develop costs and maybe some mitigation measures up front, knowing the water volume and chemistry. You could actually slightly change the configuration of your mine to avoid that. And then it goes on and on, and there's other steps. But part of doing those data quality objectives is having a good environmental team that's aware of all the different aspects of a mine site, including groundwater hydrology and surface water, geochemistry, engineering, and biology. Biology is important for your final cap system, making sure you can restore the site to its original condition, for example. And then also the process can help you with uncertainty, because no matter what you do at mine sites, there's always a degree of uncertainty. You can try your best, you can take the best environmental samples, still have certain amounts of uncertainty. So you need to understand the source of that uncertainty. Is it the chemistry or whatnot, or how much? For example, if you're predicting the volume of seepage you might get out of a waste rock pile into the future, you need to know the magnitude of it, the kind of the range of it, so you can deal with a collection and treatment system properly. So the first and the most important part at mine sites is predicting the impacts to water resources. This is typically done by multiple processes. First one would be a good water balance. Having a water balance is important. It tells you how much water is coming in and going out of the site. The second one would be the water-rock interaction, so that's the understanding the chemistry of it. Another one is the effects of mitigation. Can you reduce the effects of the water through different types of mitigation, such as covers and liners? And I'm going to cover that more. In addition, understanding transport and mixing, so how much water do you have for dilution, how far does it go to get to a surface water? These types of things are important to know. And then if you're in a carbonate environment, such as the Southwest, like in Region 9, you have a lot of carbonates, which will help attenuate any kind of contaminants. And then really understanding the receptors of all the contamination, fish, wildlife, people, is also important to know. So water balance, what do we have to do for a good water balance? It really is understanding all the inputs, the losses, and any kind of recycling that's happening, so you know how much water is coming in and going out. Part of that is understanding the waste streams. You have to know the type of water coming out of, for example, waste rock piles, tailings piles, heap leach piles, pits, etc. You also have to know these numbers during the evolution of the mine. So as it's operating, as it closes, as it moves into its inactive phases, how much water is there going to be in different parts of it, and how would you expect that to change over time, including the amount of water and the chemistry of it. And obviously, the changes associated with different seasons or extreme weather events, whether it's snow melt or whether it's in the Pacific Southwest, where you can have extreme rainfall events, etc. So, and then, of course, climate change through time, what do you expect to happen? Do you expect precipitation to increase, decrease, permafrost melting, etc.? Here's a real quick example of what you might see in a water balance conceptual site model. This one's for Thompson Creek. In this situation, the heart of it is the pit lake itself. You have precipitation in, you have evaporation out of, you have pit wall runoff, you have all these inputs coming into the pit lake. And then you have other facilities on site. For example, we have two different dumps that need to be collected, and if it's a certain chemistry or volume, it needs to be pumped back. So this before you even start, this provides a great sense of how to build your facility you configure, for example, a dump to be above your pit so the water would drain right into your pit and you wouldn't need to pump it, thereby saving costs, et cetera. So there's different ways of looking at water balance. Okay, so the next one is to understand the actual water-rock interaction. This is more related to the chemistry. So the water balance was the volume, and this one is the chemistry of it. There are many tests that evaluate waste rock materials for acid rock drainage and metal leaching potential. Many of them are ASTM methods and very standardized, which tends to make it a little bit easier. But we have different. We have many waste types. We have tailings. We have waste rock. We have heap leach types. One of the biggest issues to struggle with is the representative of this sample. So if you have, maybe you remember one of Shahid's early slides where he had that big faraway shot of that open pit mine with the ore and the waste. And in that, we have to make sure we collect a little bit of each in the right areas to make sure that once you dig it all up and pile it up, that your testing represents the pile that you end up with. And part of this is typically ending up with very large data sets. You can have hundreds and hundreds of samples. And then understanding each sample's variability is pretty important. And, of course, the interpretation could be very complicated. This is one of the most difficult parts of this whole process, is a correct interpretation or knowing the variation and the possible endpoints of this prediction. So this is an extremely complicated slide. You don't need to read it all, but the whole point is to show you some of the extreme conditions in a good baseline geochemistry study. For example, this particular site, they had over 4,000 acid rock drainage samples from 55 separate boreholes. You can kind of read down the list. We have 629 samples of XRF analysis. We have whole rock tests. We have column leach testing, which I'll show in a minute. So it's a very complex process in order to understand it completely. So one of the first tests you do at a site is their acid-base accounting. And what this does is this tests how much neutralizing capacity versus how much acid-generating capacity a particular sample might have. And what this does is it helps you predict what will probably happen to the rock as it weathers. Will it go acid? Will it go neutral? So if you plot the acid potential against the neutralizing potential, you can get a sense of where your rock sample will lie. For example, in this field, you would expect all these samples to be non-acid generating. In this field, you would expect all of these to be potentially acid generating. And then you always have a range where you're not quite sure in the middle. And those are ones you have to typically do more testing on. So at this particular site, as an example, it looks like there's quite a bit of non-acid generating samples coming back, but unfortunately it looks like there's also quite a bit of acid generating samples as well. So once you, just to skip back for one second, once you determine that you have many samples that are potentially acid generating, you go from this acid-base accounting test up to the next most complex testing method, which is called the column leach testing. And what this does is this actually simulates weathering of the sample over time. And in this particular methodology, you would put water in the top, let it percolate down, collect it. Maybe you would send some off to the lab for the testing, and the remainder you might circulate again. It over and over again in the lab, like you have some examples right here. And it would simulate the weathering of the rock, and over time, would it go acid? Would you start leaching other metals? That type of thing. So. And the sample is typically a ground-up sample. So what do you expect from these columns? So over time, you would take a sample every week, for example, in this particular example. So second week, third week, you'd keep taking chemistry samples every week as you're circulating the fluid. And over time, you would measure, for example, the change in pH or other metals of concern. In this particular sample, you can see they ran this leaching column test for 8 weeks, and then many of the tests they shut down because they realized they were at an elevated pH, which is what you'd want. But they wanted to keep an eye on some of them. For example, potentially this one has the lowest pH. They wanted to just see would it stay neutral or would it go acid. And over time, this particular one did go acid. And along with that acidity, the copper went up. So we had a copper discharge that increased in concentration, and we had a drop in pH. And then some metals, such as zinc, didn't drop. They stayed elevated. So you might want to have a target range. The red line here and the red line here both outline the acceptable pH concentrations for typical surface waters. And you want to make sure your discharges are within that range. And over time, you want to see what they will do. Copper, most of the copper leach tests in this particular site stayed low, but this one exceeded a copper standard right here and kept going up. So what this would indicate that this particular mine waste material would probably leach, and that you might have to take special precautions associated with that material as you dump it into heap leach piles or waste rock piles. Some humidity cell tests go on for quite a long period of time. This particular test went on for 103 weeks. Some of these tests are very slow, so you need extra time to see the changes that are going to happen over multiple weeks of testing. So, for example, we have sulfate concentrations. They started out high. They went down. You might have considered stopping the test, but then they suddenly spiked from various geochemical considerations. You can get the sense of the alkalinity was elevated and it starts to drop over time, very subtly, but it does tend to drop over time, which means the alkalinity is being consumed by some type of acid material potentially. So what this whole test tells you is over a long period of time, what are these changes that we can expect and how we use that prediction to build waste rock piles? Do we need extra covers? Do we need to isolate this material? These are the types of decisions you'll make with this information. So basically, when you're trying to predict and prevent acid rock drainage, you have to understand the range of acidity and some of your target concentrations. And if you're going to get some of the lower acidic concentrations in your heap leach test, there's certain things you might need to do. Also, there are modeling, computer modeling that's available. This is one that EPA has used in the past. And what it does is it enters all the geochemical processes that that are known about a certain metal or compound, and you can actually predict in a computer-based model what type of compounds and concentrations you might expect. It's always good to have non-proprietary models out there, so anybody can run them, and we can reproduce them, and you can tweak them and do some variations on them and perform a sensitivity and uncertainty analysis to see, well, if we added lime to this, would we meet water quality standards? And if you know it up front, maybe you could do that to a waste rock pile to actually prevent a discharge that you wouldn't want to happen at the site. So as we move on to surface water and groundwater impacts, prevention and control. So we're going from predicting it to what things, if we have issues, what things can we do to prevent those impacts or at least control them. So obviously the goal here is to minimize the contact between the mine waste and water. If you're going to have some chemical reaction between mine waste and the water, the best way to prevent that is to minimize the contacts. And then during mine operation, you want to, of course, maximize water reuse in order to prevent discharges. So what are the methods? We have different methods of prevention and control. For example, you could backfill a pit if you have material that will either neutralize the water or if you just want to prevent a lake forming that would have adverse geochemistry in it that could harm birds, you might want to backfill it to prevent that. You can segregate waste rock. If you have a low volume or a particular nasty acid-generating rock, you can put it high and dry up inside a waste rock pile with a cap over it inside the waste rock pile. But if you know it ahead of time, you can actually segregate it. Of course, just diverting surface water around the site makes sense. You can also use different forms of covers over the top or liners underneath in order to more efficiently either prevent with a cover or collect more efficiently with a liner. In the Southwest, you can often use evaporation as a method to get rid of some of this water that drains out of the waste rock piles or tailings. If it's a low volume, you can evaporate it. And then, of course, collection and treatment is very important. method of dealing with it. Just an example of a physical control. This is a mine in Arizona, the copper mine where the creek was blue ahead of time because of heap leach piles on each side of a creek were leaching and coming up into the creek. So the mining company put in a concrete line channel to segregate the leachate coming up into the bottom of the creek from the clean creek that was flowing through. And what it allowed it to do was the creek to safely pass through the site and return to surface water in a clean way rather than collecting all these contaminants as it went through. And then they had barrier walls along the side to prevent spills from industrial facilities from accidentally going into the creek. So this was an effective control at this particular site. Other ways of controlling, this is a evaporation pond in Arizona, which was successfully drained and graded, and soil, and it was put on top, and it was replanted over the course of many years. This was done and now is working quite well. This is an evapotranspirative cap that was used, and as of, I believe, 7 years, they've had no water infiltrating through this cap, so it's been very, very effective. Okay, other ways of dealing with the acid mine drainage would be actual water treatment. So this is the Leithen mine in California. This is a high-altitude mine. It's a former sulfur mine that has quite a bit of acid mine drainage. Different ways of dealing with it is chemical, biological, or physical treatments to take care of different situations. This is an example of an active water treatment system where you would take the acid mine drainage and lime into a container. You would mix it and react it. It would come through the flocculant, would come through the pipe. It would be separated. The relatively clean water would float to the top and be discharged, and all the precipitates would go to the bottom and be removed as sludge, which could be either dewatered or disposed of in some way on site in a safe manner. But the whole point of this is to increase the pH and then drop these metal concentrations down to an acceptable level that would meet water quality standards. There's tons of different methods of dealing with it. Just a few examples here. One is a reactive barrier. These are tricky, but they're usually dug in the subsurface above some kind of substrate. You can see the water table would be right here, and any kind of contaminants that would be flowing in the subsurface would go through this reactive barrier, which could be made of zero valent iron or other materials that would actually cause any metals in the water to adhere before it would pass through. These can clog up and might need to be redone on occasion, but they can be effective under certain low concentration situations. Other methods, if you have a gold mine that has some cyanide, residual cyanide, there's many different oxidizers that you can use to destroy the cyanide, or hopefully it could be recovered and recycled during the process for the final heap leach, but there's many methods of dealing with cyanide. So going from water impacts to other types of impacts, we have soil impacts. So for soil and land-based impacts, we can have that direct physical alteration of the loss of habitat and vegetation on site. When you strip off the trees and the vegetation in the soil, that's a direct loss. You can also have soil contamination in waste rock piles, blowing material. You can also have vegetation contamination where the vegetation itself will uptake different metals, and that can be a very tricky situation. You can have indirect impact to wildlife or subsistence users in the area. So there's different ways of controlling that. That you're listed here, you can minimize the footprint. Rather than making a 100-acre site that's 10 feet deep of waste rock, you can make a 50-acre site that's twice the thickness. So you can really reduce the footprint and minimize the impact in that way. You can take tailings and backfill either into the pit or in underground workings, so they're not on the surface. They're back down in the subsurface environment that has minimal oxygen. Like I said, backfilling waste rock into a pit. You can consolidate waste. You can reclaim, revegetate, and you can cap and cover waste as well. This is just a quick example of having a slope which is dangerous and steep and won't revegetate based on the mineralogy. You can regrade it, and you can the slopes down so they can take vegetation. You can put a slope, revegetate, and get something that you wouldn't otherwise know there was a mine there if it's done correctly. Okay, moving from soil, we covered water, and we covered soil, and now we're going to take a quick look at air concerns. Oftentimes, especially at active sites and inactive sites for tailings, you can have dust or chemical emissions. These can impact water quality. They can affect sediment and water quality. Oftentimes, you can have dust that blows off, is deposited on a nearby slope, and then washes down into the creek. Sources of air concerns can be all these that are listed here, but the main ones that we seem to see are ore crushing from active facilities and then dry tailings, or tailings that become dry at either active or inactive facilities. Other sorts of air emissions include the industrial part of it. So whenever you have a roaster or a furnace, you can have obviously emissions out of the stack or fugitive emissions that can typically contain mercury, arsenic, many other metals as well, lead, copper. And then sometimes different mines have their own power source on site or nearby, which can have the normal combustion products from power generation that can be a problem. So dust issues. Many sites, when they're processing the ore, they have large crushing facilities. And as they put it in the crusher, they would dump it, and you have a lot of dust coming up. So you could have used bag houses, cleaning filtration systems that would discharge clean air out and then control the dust generation. Other sources include trucks, which can be covered. You can use dust suppressants that you can actually spray on top of tailings to keep them from blowing. And like I said, scrubbers and filters. And then, of course, the reclamation or revegetation of especially tailings piles can cut down on dust. So successful mining closure and cleanup usually involves the physical stability to prevent different types of discharges. It can prevent long-term erosion and air emissions. We can have the chemical stability to actually prevent the leachate or the generating of poor quality water, biological stability, reestablishing vegetation cover for the long term, and then with an eye on final land use, safe access so you don't have steep slopes, and you can have productivity of the mine lands. So that's all I have to say about this one, Jean.
Okay, well, we'll take a quick break here for Q&A. We have had a few comments and questions come in throughout that portion of the talk. And the first thing I just wanted to bring up is this concept of arsenic, that arsenic can come into play at some of these types of sites. I don't know if you can comment on arsenic at mining sites.
Yeah, arsenic, it can be found widespread in naturally occurring conditions. Mining obviously tends to enhance the exposure of it, so it can leach out a little more readily. So it's unfortunately unlike acid mine drainage. Oftentimes, arsenic is at an elevated pH. It's released at an elevated pH, so it's harder to see sometimes. A stream can look normal but have high arsenic concentrations. So it's a tricky one. It's not as easy to see as your typical acid mine drainage.
And usually, Gene, for when we did our study of our Superfund sites, this is Shahid, lead and arsenic were the most prevalent contaminants found at these, at least the Superfund sites that we're dealing with. Lead was the most, at about 50 or 60% of the site, but arsenic came in like 20 or 30% of the site, so it's pretty prevalent.
Okay. All right. Excellent. We did have another question that came into play. And this was just if concrete or cement dams are being considered for improved standards for tailings impoundment instead of earth-filled dams.
I'm afraid that the question is really would they consider concrete as being more stable. The cost considerations for building a dam that large can be excessive. And also the maintenance can be pretty severe on those as well. So, you know, with earth-filled dams, over time you can stabilize them, you can revegetate them and return them. But with a to productive use, but with a concrete structure, it is, I think over the long term, it might be harder to maintain.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's also the economics of the mining that drives it. So as John said, it may be costly to do that, but yeah, over time, you may have, depending on if you've tied it to a competent bedrock and maintain it over time, it may be a good thing to do and consider. But it's the economics may not make it possible.
In California, we have a site that has a 100-year-old dam that's actually crumbling now. The concrete is actually breaking down, and the rebar's coming out of it, and we're looking at doing an emergency response on it, as opposed to right upstream, there's an earthen embankment that was done 100 years ago as well, and it seems to be intact and doing well. So that's just an example.
Okay, and we do have a few participants who are sort of chiming in, just mentioning that they see other dams that are being built with other materials. They comment about final contouring, that they're saying that they start implementing geomorphic contours, which will mimic natural contours and drainage. And again, we see other people who are talking about using rock dams, which seem to be more stable. I don't know if you guys are familiar with those.
Yeah, if you plan far enough ahead of time, the concept of recontouring it, so you build it in as it will appear in a natural landform. So when you reclaim it, it blends back into the surrounding topography more naturally. And waste rock, tailings dams made out of rock tend to be more stable, but they also will look like a pile of waste rock for a long time. So there's balancing considerations.
Okay.
And then there's also
go ahead, sorry.
Also the design of these, whether it's earthen or not, I mean, there's a difference between upstream dams versus, the center line and downstream design dams. In other words, where most of the older were upstream dams where, you sort of build one layer of the dam and then you use dry out tailings to build subsequent layers, and that may have stability issues over time, but if you sort of build out the dams from center line or, outward process, they seem to be more stable too. So those are, they're not concrete, but they're also earthen dams, which may be more stable.
Okay.
Go ahead, Jean, sir.
We did have a question about sampling. One of the participants wanted to know, how closely does EPA review methods of sampling? For example, the number, the randomized selection of locations, how long the testing took place, to evaluate whether your baseline geochemistry assessment is adequate or accurate?
This is typically one of the most difficult parts of it, is getting a sense of all the different rock formations in an area and the chemical variation of it, and having good baseline background data on that to help you select the volume and number of samples and the distribution of those samples for your basic testing. Acid basic counting testing. And the length of time to run humidity cell tests can be very tricky. ASTM requires at a minimum a certain amount, typically, I forget what it is, 20 weeks, I'm not sure.
20 weeks.
Yeah, 20 weeks. But typically they need to go longer, especially that are on the edge. If a column test clearly goes acid in 10 weeks, you don't need to keep running it, right? But if a site looks like there might be some variation, like I showed there on the sulfate, or if it tends to be dipping and going back up and down, that shows you that there's an active chemical process going on. So that column test leach, you might want to let go a little bit longer to let it play out all the way. So much of it really is site-specific. It's hard to have a hard set of rules associated with that.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. I think perhaps in the interest of time, we might go ahead and carry on with the presentation, but we do still have time left today to have another break for Q&A. I believe at this point, Shahid, you'll continue on with the next portion of the talk, correct?
That's correct. So the baton's back to me. Thanks, John. So basically, the first part, we sort of outlined for you the, you know, the features and the problems that may be associated with hard rock mining and the environmental consequences. And then John was, you know, very well put in the how we can prevent these sites and try to, you know, control these sites from becoming long-term legacy sites. What I wanted to cover next is sometimes a lot of these sites do become long-term legacy sites which need to be dealt with, and so what kind of cleanup approaches we can take at those sites once they're either abandoned or inactive. So what can we do at these sites, and how do we address the environmental releases, and how do we make these sites, you know, safe for human health and the environment, protective of human health and the environment. So this is a picture of the, it's a DOE site, it's the Moab site, it's UMTRCA, which is the Uranium Mine Tailing Reclamation Act site, and basically it's what it shows is it's just sort of the mill tailings have been covered up and capped, and there's some groundwater components associated with cleaning up groundwater at this site as well. So again, a lot of these sites are large and complex, and when they go wrong, when things go wrong with them, and basically there's different ways to approach these sites. State and federal programs, like states have their own programs to permit and operate and oversee sites, as well as address these sites, as well as federal agencies such as the Bureau of Land Management, the Forest Service, Park Service on federal lands also have programs to make the mining companies or operators comply with the different programs that are established either by the state or the federal land management agencies. There's also state contaminated site programs. So basically, you may have a state that may have some sort of a fee or some sort of a way to address these sites should there not be enough financial assurance or some sort of money left from those compliance programs to address these sites. So there's a state contaminated sites program. And then basically the third one is, you know, the one that we're kind of run at EPA, but there's also BLM and Forest Service have this authority of the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation Liability Act, or Superfund, or CERCLA, which is at the end of the day, when there is no other program really you know, can deal with these types of sites, a lot of some of these sites end up on the Superfund, either being addressed by EPA, or if it's on federal land by the Bureau of Land Management or Forest Service. There was an executive order 12580, which was signed back in the 80s, which gave delegated parts of CERCLA authority to BLM and Forest Service to try to address their sites under the Superfund authority. So, again, CERCLA, which is Superfund, this is, again, I just want to show you, this is the Berkeley Pit in Montana. It was a copper mine, legacy mine. It's filling up. pH is about 2 or 3, really acidic water. Matter of fact, they've even put in some blowhorns, so, in other words, at sensors, so when birds fly in, the horns blow, so they don't land in this water. It's so acidic, it's that bad over there. But for CERCLA, what Congress did is they provided EPA with the authority at that time to respond to any type of a release of hazardous substance, pollutant, or contaminant, which could present either an imminent or substantial danger to human health and the environment. So basically, it provides the legal authority to EPA, and then it was also authorized under Executive Order 12580 to have BLM and Forest Service take parts of CERCLA actions on their lands to take actions. And the beauty about CERCLA is that it's not media specific. It addresses all media. It could be air, soil, sediments, groundwater, surface water, and does not have, but unfortunately it does not cover petroleum. Petroleum, there was an exclusion, so CERCLA does not apply to petroleum products. So basically, it has been used mostly out of the 100. There's 140 sites that are either on the national priorities list that have either been proposed or finalized, deleted, or being addressed as a Superfund alternative site. In other words, they use a CERCLA method to go forward, but the site does not get placed on the Superfund national priorities list. And you can use that to address abandoned sites, and we've used it in a few cases for active sites as well. So it is a pretty broad authority that covers multimedia and gives us the authority to address these releases and to protect human health and the environment. Again, the response authorities are variable, includes both removal and remedial action authorities. This is John's site, actually. It used to be. It's the Hayden smelter site, and they're doing yard remediation over here. It was a smelter. I think it was arsenic and lead contamination, so they're doing yard remediation over there. So in essence, you could do removal or remedial actions. Removal actions are usually a short-term action to stabilize or clean up the hazard site that poses the imminent or endangerment to human health and the environment. And, you know, it's, in essence, there is some sort of a cap for how much expenditures you can put into these sites. It's capped at, like, I think, $2 million, and it's a time period of 1 year. But if it takes longer to do that, generally what we try to do is put it on the national priorities list so you can have a longer time to clean up. So, for instance, if you have groundwater and surface water type of contamination which needs a longer term to clean up, longer time to clean up, you try to place those on the national priorities list, which then also makes it eligible for additional funding to take these long-term remedial actions. There's also within the EPA an enforcement first type of provision where we try to get the primary potential responsible party to pay for it, this such action, and to compel them to pay for those actions at those sites. So there's these different types of provisions in CERCLA, and it whichever type of action you take, whether it's removal or remedial, there is the regulations tied to this law, which is the National Contingency Plan, where all the actions need to comply with relevant and appropriate requirements. So in other words, all laws and standards, whether they're federal laws and applicable or appropriate state laws, or there may be some tribal laws that may be appropriate for addressing these sites and taking actions at these sites. So that's basically, in a nutshell, what the response authorities are under CERCLA or the Superfund. This is a site, this is the abandonmylands.gov site, which is, we have a working relationship over here in Washington with BLM and Forest Service and Park Service, and we jointly try to share our information on the different mines that we're dealing with and that we're aware of, but there are hundreds of thousands of mining sites which are across the country. I mean, there's been figures out there that's between 100 and 500,000. There's no real inventory, a national inventory that has been done. States have their own abandoned mine sites as well. So there's not like a national inventory that's been done of the abandoned sites across the nation. And secondly to that we don't have what the priority sites are at these different locations either. So, again, a lot of the issues revolve, as you know, John has been saying, and what I said earlier, is like surface and groundwater contaminations along with sediment contamination that occurs from the surface water. For a lot of the like the U.S. Forest Service and BLM, those are public lands, and there's a lot of safety issues associated with these sites. Like, as you see, there's an open hole. People are curious. There's open adits, and, you know, there's bikers and hikers that may, you know, be injured. This could be a real issue at these sites as well. And, you know, we have efforts underway to try to work together to identify where these sites are, but we'll continue to identify where the inventories are, what for the different land managers as well as EPA and states. But there is, again, there is no national inventory. Again, getting into the Superfund or the CERCLA response process, this is just a pipeline diagram of how a site gets discovered to all the way how it gets closed out. So what I'll do here is just sort of walk you through each one of these processes. So in essence, what you have is a state or a tribe or essentially a public a person like a citizen could have, you know, could be walking around a site or could be discovering and see some sort of release happening from some of these sites. They could see some orange-colored water or see some, basically slouching tailings or some sort of features that they have a concern. They can notify through EPA, this National Response Center, that something's happening. EPA can get involved in, trying to get some other action going. It could be the state that could be notifying us. It could be the nation, like the tribal people, entities could be also identifying these, and as a concern, they could be smelling water that they're drinking. So there's different ways of discovery and notification that EPA can be pulled in, or you know, other authorities can be pulled in to respond to these types of sites. Once that is done, and if EPA deems it that you know this is something that's worthwhile investigating, and that it should be pursued, what we start then is what we call the assessment phase. And that's basically looking at it and looking at what's going on at this site, what are the contaminants that has the substances that may be emanating from this site, what are the contaminants of concern that may be, you know, is it lead, is it arsenic, is it mercury, is it uranium, whatever the contaminants may be, what are some of the exposure pathways, is it groundwater, surface water, and what are some of the potential receptors? So is it, are there children, are there sensitive, rare wildlife that's being impacted, or some sensitive, you know, ecosystems that's being impacted. So looking at, you know, what the contaminants are, what the exposure pathways are, what the potential receptors are, then if they decide to move forward and it's a short-term action, again, it could be done under removal authorities, and the site could be, if it's a small enough site, could be addressed and responded to. However, a lot of these sites end up needing longer-term types of response actions, so they may have to go through what they call the NPL, which is the National Priorities List, where we place the highest priority sites on this list of hazardous substances that may have occurred. So we do have a number of the mining sites that have been listed on the NPL. As I said, you know, we have 140 or so mining and mineral processing sites on the NPL, or they're proposed or they've been deleted. And a lot of these sites, as you may know, as you saw some of the pictures, are very, very large and complex. So about 50% of our sites that are on the NPL are about 500 acres or more. So they're really, really large sites, and they have, have large reaches as well for water impacts. And then while the sites, the 140 sites, only represent about 8% of the whole National Priorities List universe, about 20% of the highest cost come from these sites. So 20% of these sites are mega sites, what we call $50 million or more to address these types of sites. So, you know, as these things go on, these are large, complex sites that are going to need significant resources to address in the future. So if there's a way to prevent these from happening and to reduce the footprint and environmental consequences, that's a best way to go forward. So anyway, you do the assessment, you try to figure out what the contaminant concerns are, You try to, after that, once you know what your contaminants are, what your media of contamination is, what you need to do to address that, you come up and you select a remedy, or you propose different types of remedies that you propose, and you come up with a proposed plan to the public that you're thinking of doing either active treatment at for water treatment facilities, doing some sort of a cap or some other type of a technique for reducing source areas or source contamination. So you present that and you have a public meeting. You have basically what you go through is a 9 criteria analysis. If it's on the national priorities list, you look at, you know, is it protective of human health and environment, or and it doesn't meet what I was saying is applicable, relevant, and appropriate standards. Does it meet the water quality standards? So those are threshold criteria that every remedy that is selected needs to meet. Then you have what they call is a balancing criteria for short-term, long-term effectiveness. Does it reduce toxicity, mobility, and the volume? Is it and how cost-effective it is? And is it implementable under the conditions? So those are basically the balancing criteria that you look at. You balance against each one of the remedies that you're kind of proposing. And then what you have is a modifying criteria, which is the state is accepting the remedy and the proposed remedy, and obviously the public, the community acceptance. So basically you walk through that, and then you basically looking at what you have, then you come up with a record of decision for the site. And this is, again, for a national priority list site. And then you sort of do a design of your remedy and do a remedial design. And then you start the construction, which is called a remedial action. You clean up the site. And then basically you could, for some sites that don't require long-term maintenance and operation and long-term water treatment type of thing, you could sort of delete the site from the NPL because you've addressed all the pathways and the all the human health risk and the ecological risk for those sites. So, it, you know, I went through this really quickly, and that's, you know, there's days that they spend on this process. So I just wanted to put that in a quickly go through that. And again, you know, we're trying to get PRPs to pay for this since the responsible parties created that, and we keep the communities engaged throughout the process. Some conventional remedial technologies and approaches we've taken at mining sites, and John's covered some of that, is the chemical treatment of, you know, the contaminated waters, the mine-influenced waters. Could be, you know, you, the typical lime treatment. You could have sulfide-reducing bacteria, you know, SRB reactors, or some sort of a passive system that can be used for treating water. And for the source control, you could do sort of the capping and covering, or if you have waste rock or tailings or other areas that could, you can excavate and maybe dispose it in the pit or some other methods or in some sort of repository on site. So those are some of the conventional techniques that have been used for these. Other things that have been used is diversion of surface water from coming into contact with the source area, so you sort of reduce how many gallons per minute you need to treat at a conventional treatment plant. So that's another method that's been used in the past for some of these sites. Other innovative technologies we're looking at is this passivation. This is this, let's see where the arrow go. Sorry. This is spray-on type of a technology, which sort of is on a pit wall. You sort of apply this either in solution or in some sort of a slurry form, and you know you sort of spray the walls to sort of take the oxidation potential away, and you know because you're starving the oxygen from coming into contact with the sulfide and water. So this is something that's it's not been tried out in a full scale. It's been small applications have been tried, but you know this is something that's something that we may want to look at and think about. There's the phytoremediation type of a technology where you use plants to remediate soils, and you know they uptake the contaminants into the plants, and you can harvest the plants and dispose of them appropriately. So there's that part of it as well. So those are a couple of techniques, and then you have passive treatment systems that can be applied for waters, for mine influence waters. Now, I wanted to also jump into and just sort of point out to you EPA's green remediation initiative in trying to do greener cleanups and to try to reduce the carbon footprint. Basically, what you see over here is the Cuesta molybdenum mine site, which is we used like 20 acres of this to put solar panels on there, which is generating 1 megawatt of power for the town of Cuesta. Do we want to do this video here, Jean? Or
certainly, we'll pull this video up now. Just a quick note to our participants, this video does have audio associated with it, so you'll need to adjust your own speakers correctly in order to hear the video as it plays back.
The mine's history goes back almost 100 years when two prospectors first discovered a dark metallic substance in a mountain range in northern New Mexico. They later learned they had found molybdenum, an element used to harden metals. The CPV solar farm sits atop the mine's tailings field.
We're standing at the tailings facility in an area where the sand is probably about 40 to 60 feet deep. The sand has been capped off with soil between 1 foot and 3 foot deep.
Okay, we'll go back to your slide, Shahid. But if anybody had any difficulty hearing those videos, we'll share links with those at the conclusion of today's webinar so you can play it back on your own time as well. Shahid, feel free to carry on.
Sorry, I was on mute. Yeah, so basically, you know, what we're trying to show here is the productive reuse of some of these facilities. They don't just need to be fenced off and capped. There may be other reuse opportunities associated with it, and, you know, green remediation is one of the elements that EPA is strongly advocating it for these sites, whether they be solar, wind, or other type of green technologies that may be applied and reuse, and even other types of reuse opportunities at these types of sites. So anyway, in conclusion, you know, from all of our discussion, you know, as you've heard, is these are huge operations and involve the movement of very large quantities of materials, be they waste rock and tailings, as you've heard, and heap leaches, and they are huge facilities, and there are ways to, as John went over, to prevent some of the contamination occurring and to control and remediate these once it happens. So in other words, prevention may be better than cure. So, you know, if we can prevent these and having best management practices applied to prevent these so they don't lead to a, you know, long-term legacy type of a issue, that long-term cost that's associated with remediating these sites is something that we want to consider. Other keys are to, first of all, as John went through some of his slides, is understanding, you know, what the weight characteristics, waste characteristics, the geochemistry, the mineralogy involved in these types of operations, and these different types of features that are produced, you know, from these operations, different source areas, looking at, and very importantly, looking at the water balance and environmental conditions. And, of course, the big key is the uncertainties associated with some of these sites and the long-term prediction of what's going to happen at these sites, and is it going to go acid? Is it going to, you know, what kind of releases are going to happen from these facilities as we move forward? So keeping those uncertainties in mind, we want to minimize the footprint by, you know, minimizing the contact of the water. And, you know, John went through some of the prevention techniques of how we can do that. And, you know, trying to get that is so we can have a less of a footprint in the future and less cost to associate it with cleaning these up. Again, you start with and design foreclosure, so you're taking the best practices you can to minimize environmental consequences associated with it. And, of course, important part is monitoring and inspecting these sites once they have been, you know, constructed, and to see how they're operating, how they're performing, are what you were looking at in the past, your uncertainties, can they be become less uncertain? Can you figure out and monitor and inspect these sites to, you know, to lower your uncertainties and see if you can make some changes while you're operating? And then, of course, you know, you're implementing this and complying with these types of facilities and the permit conditions, and you know, we need to consider the enforcement of the environmental regulations that are going to be applied to these sites. So that's basically, you know, big sites, big problems in the future. What can we do to avoid these from happening, or to at least lower or reduce or minimize the footprint? And then make sure that we have the proper inspection and oversight of these sites going forward, so you know they have less of consequences in the future. All right, so that kind of concludes, it does conclude our presentation. Again, I just wanted to point out that there's another one coming up, the regulatory process and how the public and tribes can engage in the regulatory process. That's scheduled for June 8th again. And so this concludes module number 2. Gene, I guess, you know, can answer questions or take questions.
That's exactly correct. I think we're going to use our remaining time here to go through a number of outstanding questions that we still have in the queue. If that's okay, then we'll turn things over to Lynn for some final thoughts as we close out today. So I'm going to go back to some of the questions that have come in, but for those participants who are staying on the line with us, you can continue to submit those questions and comments in the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen. And this first question that I'm going to take online specifically gets into the heart of CERCLA and what it's to be used for. And this participant mentions that CERCLA is meant to address, quote, imminent danger, but it can take a very long time to get things done under that particular regulatory scheme. Are there other actions or options in which the government can implement a remedy faster?
Well, as I said, the only way that we can sort of get to it is through a series of removal actions that we can do to address source areas of contamination. But some of these longer-term actions that are needed, like water treatment, long-term, you know, some of them are perpetual water treatment. And, you know, there's issues associated with funding as well, that whether it's a PRP site, which is a responsible party site, which we can go to compel the responsible party to clean up maybe, but that also, again, is dragged in court a lot of times to see how quickly we can get it done. So, again, you know, can we do it faster? Under Superfund, there's, you know, again, there is no, and this is, again, this is, I'm not speaking on behalf of the agency. This is my opinion. The Superfund is limited in resources, so it's difficult. There's competition for sites, and there's sites that are wood treater sites or solvent sites that are competing with mining sites for funding. So funding has a lot of impact on how we can get these sites done. But just the sheer magnitude, the complexity associated with these types of sites, it's going to take a while to address these. So I don't know if there's a quick answer or a quick, you know, or like a silver bullet to address these types of sites. It just, they're complex. They take a while to do. And the funding sometimes is there, sometimes it's not.
Okay. All right. Excellent. Thank you. We're going to just take a quick question here, and this is just a regulatory question. One of the participants wants to know exactly what regulations currently cover the design of tailing structures.
I'll take a stab at it first, John, and then if you want to jump in, that's fine. Basically, EPA does not generally regulate mining. I mean, it's under either in the federal land management agency's purview if it's on federal lands, or states have sort of like the NEPA EIS authorities for these lands. So, you know, EPA does comment on the EIS, the environmental impact statements associated with this, but have limited authority for specifying a design and construction of these types of facilities. So it is a limited influence there for EPA. Even for regulating and overseeing these, we've talked to folks in the federal land management agencies as well as the states. It's not a full comprehensive program that which particular agency within a state or which particular part of the federal land management agencies oversees and inspects these. The Corps of Engineers involved, MSHA, which is the Mine Safety Health Association authority, I guess, is also involved in inspecting and these active sites. So it's not one comprehensive program that can look at it and regulate it and enforce on it. John, you may please, if you have something else to add.
Just to add to what you had said is, you know, EPA is really, we regulate stuff once it becomes a waste. And before it comes a waste, we don't have jurisdiction over it typically. So we have RCRA permits for RCRA waste. We have Clean Water Act discharges once you're discharging to a stream, that type of thing. But we have no jurisdiction before it becomes a waste, just in a nutshell.
Okay, excellent. And we did have a few participants sort of chime in that you're mentioning the exact same regulations, the Corps of Engineers, FEMA, MSHA, or MSHA. Yep, you're right on track with that. We did have another question come in, and this is an interesting one about remediation technologies. And they're just wondering if there is a difference in approving remediation technology as an improvement for a Superfund site versus permitting a mine that's using a mitigation technology which reduces but not completely eliminates the adverse impacts. Are those seen differently by EPA?
Could you clarify? I mean, I'm just trying to figure the question out.
Is EPA more okay, or would EPA be more willing to approve a remedial technology as an improvement for a Superfund site rather than allowing a mine operator to use a mitigation technology that reduces but does not eliminate adverse impacts? And if you sort of think about it, if it's gone to the Superfund site phase, waste has already been discharged, and now we're going in there to clean it up, versus we've got someone who's actively using a mining site, and they have a technology that they could install while they're actively using that mining site to try to minimize the environmental impacts of the mining activities, but not necessarily eliminate it completely.
Go ahead, John.
It's kind of a false either-or question.
Yes.
you obviously want to install anything up front to prevent something from happening, because that will probably save you in the long run. But if it doesn't quite work, or you still have some residual contamination, you're definitely on the hook for taking care of that as well. But it comes to, you know, a lot of times it comes down to cost benefit. A lot of times by doing something up front, it costs a little bit more up front, but in the long term, it really saves a lot of money.
Okay.
Yeah, and the thing is that, you know, we're kind of at the end for Superfunds, you know, we have to meet our statutory mandate of protecting human health and the environment, so the remedy needs to meet certain standards. So I would say that, you know, we would have to meet certain standards to do that. And for the mining sites that are operational, you know, it's kind of tough to, because of the low influence that, less influence that the EPA has in permitting or overseeing or enforcing against operating mines, that's, you know, it's a different regulation there. So, I mean, we, for Superfund, have to meet some certain stringent standards to comply with, you know, meeting human health and the environment and complying with standards that we need to. So we do select the remedies that may be a little bit more protective. So, I mean, I'm just saying that the question can come, you know, you can split the question of different ways how you want to answer that.
Okay. I did have a few people bring up questions about disposal in lakes. So I'm going to read off some of these questions so you can get a sense of what the audience is thinking about. One of the attendees wanted you to distinguish between tailing impoundments and disposal in lakes. That it, some of the examples you were showing seemed to be more of an impoundment or reservoir. And then related to that, a few other people wanted to know, you know, why would EPA ever allow disposal in a lake? That just seems like you're allowing people to completely discharge a contaminant, and it seems to automatically have an adverse effect. So why would that ever be permitted? And then again, questioning, you know, is EPA still allowing operators to use lakes as treatment systems, or is this something that we're phasing out? So lots of questions about lakes as disposal or treatment systems.
Yeah, I mean, the tailings were like, you know, those were tailings that were dams that were constructed. Those weren't in, you know, in lakes. But this one, the Kensington mine case, I don't recall EPA. I think this is an Alaska site that was permitted by Alaska, and I think they have the Clean Water Act authorities to do this. I'm not quite sure that, you know, I mean, personally, no, I wouldn't allow this thing to happen personally. I don't know where EPA, but John, you know, I don't know what EPA really, I don't know what influence we had on this one.
Well, just to put it in its proper setting, I work in Region 9 I do not work up in Alaska, but I don't think there's a lot of lake disposal of tailings that I know of. I've just heard of this one, and there could be others, but it's not something I don't think EPA encourages or promotes or anything. I think it was proposed, and so we interacted with the entity that was doing it. So it was a pretty unique situation, and there's a lot of issues connected with the Clean Water Act with this, and so it's complicated. It's certainly, like I said, not very common.
Hey, Lynn, did you want to chime in, since I think you're Region 10 and you can sort of talk to this?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, this mine in particular had kind of a long and twisted history. They originally were permitted for a dry stack, and then it proved to be more economically feasible to discharge into the lake. And there definitely was, you know, debate between EPA and the Corps, and in the end they were able to legally discharge this as a provision of the Clean Water Act, the waste treatment exclusion. So this became kind of a component of their treatment. And it actually, you know, this project actually went to the Supreme Court. So it's kind of it is a really interesting case study that, you know, having a webinar just on these types of things would be probably fascinating. But yeah, they were able to legally do that. And I think it is pretty rare.
Okay, excellent. And we do have a number of people sort of chiming in that they also echo that Kensington Lake is the only one that they're aware of. Some people are bringing in the idea that there are now precedents that are being set. So that concept of this is a very interesting concept, and people might be interested in a webinar on this idea in the future. So we'll probably move past this one. But I do want to go into another question that came in. This one is asking if there are any sites where EPA or BLM have installed perpetual water treatments at an NPL site.
Yeah, I'll take that. Basically, some of these sites that we've selected for long-term water treatment, they will continue to operate some of the sites like the Clear Creek, Sun City Clear Creek site in Colorado, maybe Summit Gill site in Colorado, and some of the sites that we have up in Montana. And even Iron Mountain, I know, John, maybe you could chime in on that, but those are sites that will require, we just say long-term water treatment, but in essence, the geochemistry and the site-specific conditions will require long-term, probably perpetual water treatment systems. John, did you have Iron Mountain?
Yeah. Iron Mountain is projected its cost 180 years out into the future because the net present value of money, it turns to zero at that point. And so there's no projected, I don't know if the model goes to thousands of years into the future of creating affine drainage. So that's pretty much perpetuity. So some of these sites will be forever.
Yeah, as I said earlier, you know, you still have those Roman and Venetian mines still going assets. So some of these will take that long, you know, I don't know if you want to call it perpetual, but very, very, very long time.
Okay. I'm going to take one more question now before we start to have our closing statements and thoughts and final reminders. One of our participants would like you to discuss technical issues or just things to be aware of based on changing environmental conditions. So if we have climate change or irregular environmental events that happen, are there technical issues that they need to think about or be aware of at a mining site?
Climate change is one big thing that we sort of have discussed in designing tailings or designing any of these, a lot of these features, because you may have a 100-year event in one day, not one day, but you may just have something that what you've designed for to accommodate a 100-year flood may not be appropriate because of climate change conditions. I'm just talking theoretically, but, you know, there are extreme, you know, rain events or precipitation events that may need to be considered when you're designing these different types of features, facilities. John?
Yeah, I mean, in other words, you'll go from a standard 100-year model to a 200-year model just to help deal with the more extreme events that we seem to be seeing. Another example is up in Alaska, if you're counting on permafrost, or like an access area, or to buttress, or to be a part of a waste disposal facility, it might be difficult to count on the permafrost. So you might need to redesign the facility to not assume the permafrost will be there.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. I think in the interest of time, we have reached 3 o'clock. Scheduled end time, so I'd like to turn things over to one of our session organizers, Lynn Hood, for some closing thoughts, and then I'll carry out with our final reminders. So, Lynn?
Hi, Jean. Thanks, and thank you again, everyone that participated. I did want to point out we have one of the links to resources that we shared, if folks are interested in learning more about acid rock drainage, is the GARD Guide, which came out a couple of years ago. So it's still pretty new, and there's an online version that's kind of continually updated. But basically, it was developed by the International Network for Acid Prevention. It goes over prediction, prevention, and management of ARD. So it's just an interesting and good source to have in your back pocket. Other than that, I did want to mention that our next part three, our final part of the webinar, is on June 8th, and that will go over the regulatory process and how the public and tribes can engage. So I hope that you will join us for that. So thank you so much, and I'll turn it back to you, Jean.
All right, thanks so much, Lynn. So let me walk everybody through just a few final reminders. We do have webinar certificates that you can generate after filling out feedback for today's live event. A few of you have sort of chimed in that you had a few issues, but you tried to resubmit the request again and it went through. We are still testing this tool out. So if you would like to receive a participation certificate for today's webinar, please stay with me while I explain how you can submit feedback and actually obtain one of these certificates. In order to get one, you will need to share feedback for today's event. The feedback URL will be active from this point forward. When you get to that feedback form, at the bottom of it, there's a box that you need to check that at least confirms or verified that you either attended the whole live event or replayed the entire recorded event. If you don't check that box, no certificate will be generated. Once you click that box and you submit your submission on the form, you'll immediately be able to view, print, or save a PDF version of the certificate, and we'll also email it to you as a PDF attachment. As noted, we are still taking in comments and trying to improve this tool, so we really do appreciate your testing of it and letting us know if it's working and what you think of it and if it's a useful feature. As I said, you can submit feedback at any point after today's live delivery. You can also reach me directly at ballot.gene@epa.gov to share your thoughts about this feature. Copies of the presentation material, as well as links to the Part 1 archive and the guide that Lynn mentioned and other related resources can be found on the seminar links or resources page, which is active from this point forward. If you'd like to follow up with additional comments or questions, we do have contact information for our organizers and presenters. You'll find that on the seminar homepage. And as I said, please take a moment and fill out that online feedback form. I do read each and every submission, so you can do me a huge favor by filling that out to help us improve future deliveries. If you shared the line with multiple parties, each person can fill out their own form and get their own certificate. If you watch the archive version, you can still click on the link to the feedback form and fill that out and get a certificate. So with that, we did have about 150 individuals who joined us from all over the country today. I want to thank those individuals. And it looks like, Lynn, you have one other final reminder before we end things today.
Yes, I did just want to thank John and Shahid so much for volunteering your time to share your experience and knowledge with us. It was really awesome to have you. Thanks.
Thanks for inviting us.
A pleasure.
Thank you. Again, we'll echo our great big thanks to everybody who joined us today. And we will share the recorded version of today's webinar in approximately 2 days as soon as it's available. You're welcome to forward that email link on to those who will find it a valuable expenditure of your time. So I hope you'll all join us on June 8th when we carry on and conclude the Part 3 of this webinar series. And with that, this will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.